So this is exciting. And not surprising somehow. I don't know if you noticed, a couple months ago we had a conversation about the very early days of Coast to Coast. And I had made mention of the fact that we weren't entirely sure when my first date was that I filled in for Art Bell, because there was a paper system back then. It was pre-computer. And so there was kind of a, it's a filing system, and sometimes those get a little jumbled. So we're not exactly sure. We know it's been about 20 years since I've been doing Coast to Coast, but we couldn't be quite sure. And that sometimes happens with guests. We just found out it happened with our next guest, Dr. E. Lee Spence. Dr. Spence himself, we had listed as a first-time guest tonight. Turns out he was on the show a long time ago. We'll start off with that question before we get into the current state of shipwrecks, and one in particular I'm curious about, to see if he can inform this conversation on Coast to Coast AM. This is Ian Punnett. Well, if I were to take a guess, Dr. Lee Spence, underwater archaeologist, shipwreck historian, treasure hunter, author, editor, and award-winning diver and cartographer, if I were to take a guess as to why you were on Coast to Coast many years ago, before we went to a computerized system, it would be because of your discovery of the Hunley. How's my guess?
Are we on the air now?
We are.
I was trying to figure that out too. It may have been, but it also may have been. I think this is actually what it was. I had discovered that Rhett Butler was based on a real person.
Yeah, the
And
Trenholm guy.
yes, that's correct.
Interesting.
And so it was one of the two, and it may have actually been both. I don't
Yeah.
remember if I hear it on here twice.
Well, you know what? Or the same show, because I remember the discovery of the Hunley, and this is the submarine, the sort of it's rudimentary submarine that was lost during the Civil War. And so you were part of that. You were part of the discovery team that found the Hunley.
I was the person that found it. I
You were the
actually
person.
found it back in 1970. I was, I guess, 23 years old or so.
Amazing. Well, it's good
But
to have you
back
back
then, no,
on.
back at that time, no one was really interested in it. And then I ended up writing a book, and in the book, it told about the real Rhett Butler, who had been the owner of the Georgiana, another wreck I had found, and it told of my discovery of Hunley. And then that sparked a great deal of interest, and the Hunley ended up, quote, being rediscovered
Yeah.
by others,
Funny.
but it was exactly where I had mapped it all
That's
those
funny.
years ago.
So the Trenholm conversation, let's start there real quickly, because I think just for people who don't know, I mean, the character of Rhett Butler from Gone with the Wind is this very wealthy gun runner who had figured out ways to get guns to the Confederate cause, but was also a war profiteer, which added to his sort of rakish image in the book and in the movie, of course. But that's consistent with a guy who actually did exactly that.
Well, George Trenholm actually made today's equivalent of over $1 billion in just 5 years of blockade running. But he wasn't just running one ship. He was involved in about 70 different vessels, about 30 of them that he owned and the others that he leased and all. But even in Gone with the Wind, it says that he had several vessels.
Yeah. Well, it makes sense. I mean, as an archetype, it's perfect. But so, I mean, this conversation started because I think, let me, I would, I'm, I don't know this if it's true for everybody, but I would say of everybody I know, if they had 10 lives to live, one of those would be spent as an underwater archaeologist diving for treasure because it's so much fun and it just sounds really cool. And that actually is the life that you have chosen, and you were one of the earliest to be rewarded a PhD in this particular discipline, which is amazing. And you continue to be on the forefront of this as technology changes. And so that's my interest on this, is that with all of the satellite technology that we have, we are finding things which may have been underneath, where we were sailing past all these years and not really noticing. Or is it? Is the technology that we have from satellites really making a difference for a marine archaeologist to find the shipwrecks that have been lurking there all along?
Well, there are some that are being found that way, but most of them are being found through different types of things like magnetometers, side scan sonars, LIDAR, and stuff like that. And what they're able to do with all this new technology is find stuff that before we were overlooking. And so it's just absolutely amazing what's being discovered now. There were several million shipwrecks, and the Smithsonian years ago had written that over two-thirds of all the gold and silver ever mined in history now lies on the ocean's floor. So there's a lot to be found out there.
But it isn't just for the money, although that still like gets you goosebumpy, doesn't it? But that idea of the lost history that's waiting at the bottom of the ocean to be found, just like the Hunley, or this other ship, which we'll get to a little bit later on, that is making a well, I'll say making waves. But I mean, you've got a this is the beautiful part of the marine archaeology part is the kind of things that marine archaeology can use to either confirm or deny the historical record.
That's correct.
What is your favorite thing to look for other than buried treasure underwater?
Oh, I love finding ships a unique history to them. That's what it was with the Hunley. The idea of finding the Hunley, it was the very first ship, well, very first submarine in history to actually sink an enemy ship in warfare.
Right.
And the distinction I put there had been a number of submarines built over the years, and some had sunk vessels and tests, but this was a real run, and it was a true submarine. It could dive entirely under another ship. It could stay submerged for over an hour. When they were building it, believe it or not, their original intent was to put an electric motor in the thing. But it was during the Civil War, and the South didn't have access to something like that. They did exist, but they didn't have access to it. And so they had it hand cranked.
Right.
And its victim was 3.5 miles offshore. And they actually hand cranked that thing 3.5 miles offshore at night, got to the right target, attacked it, and sank it.
And died in the process, which I think they made a TV movie, didn't they, of this, or TBS had, I want to say, some special on it, because I remember seeing a recreation of it, and it's not for anybody who suffers from claustrophobia. I mean, it was like a giant hot dog tube with people in there all cramped and cranking this thing, trying to get, trying to get a few knots going so that they could attack the ship.
I don't see how they did it.
Yeah.
They really, really had to be dedicated.
And
Or
they weren't
believe
supposed
it
to
or
die,
not,
though. It wasn't supposed to be a suit. I'm sorry, go ahead.
part of their dedication, though, was not just for their country. These men, if they had made it back alive, would have split to today's equivalent of over $500,000.
Oh, interesting.
And
Well, you're
so that would have been a real nice reward. The man who was putting up that money, believe it or not, was George Trenum.
So he was doing that. And I'm sorry if I stepped on you there. The volume is a little fainter in my headphones than it usually is, so I couldn't hear that you were talking. I didn't mean to talk over you, it wasn't intended to be, and you answered the question. It wasn't intended to be a suicide mission, not like the
No.
Japanese, some of the Japanese submarines, the little one or two person subs in World War II, right?
No, it was not supposed to be a suicide mission. It had sunk twice before, so they knew it was dangerous. It had killed two of its own crews before accidentally sinking, but they were convinced they could do it and come back alive.
Well,
Just very, very dangerous.
so again, we're talking with Dr. Lee Spence, marine archaeologist, and the how many shipwrecks? I mean, if you had mentioned you talked about the figure of a million, but how many shipwrecks do we think are lying at the bottom of the ocean that are not tagged, not identified? We don't, they're just there. If we had to go by the odds of the number of ships that once sailed, that sank in a storm or through other mishaps, how many shipwrecks are out there yet to be discovered?
It is literally millions of them. To give you a for instance, if you did a 5 mile radius sitting on Fort Sumter at the entrance of Charleston Harbor, you would take in about 2,000 shipwrecks just at that one entrance to a harbor.
But how many of those are known?
Oh, maybe 100 of those have been found, most of which I found.
Okay, that's so cool. The Charleston is, and that era and that part of the country, that's obviously a little bit more of your that's your expertise, which is very cool. How many marine archaeologists do what you do around the world now?
I don't know. There are actually quite a few of them now. It would be hundreds of them today, but back when I started, of course, you could put everybody working on shipwrecks in one room.
Yeah.
It wouldn't have to be a big room. I mean, we would have international meetings, and would people would come from all over the world, and
You
we'd
could
have
do it.
25 people there.
I was gonna say, you could do it in a large Winnebago
Yeah.
convention. So, but now it's, and that is still amazing. I hope that you get that great satisfaction knowing that you are on the ground floor of something which, is yet even then probably to come to its full fruition. As we spend a lot of time and energy exploring space, it remains true that we would know more about us and about our history if we put the same energies in exploring the oceans.
The day that man actually landed on the moon, I was diving on a treasure wreck, a Spanish galleon off Vero Beach, Florida. And I found a swivel gun that day, but ABC was filming a moment in history. I was diving with Mel Fisher, who later found the Atosha.
Sure.
And so that's what we were doing that day.
My mother has a coin from that, from the Atosha.
Wow.
She loved that whole story so much, and she raised us with this love of the idea of the sunken treasure. So we're focusing then on certain. You have a specialty in terms of ships from the. From the around the Civil War era, and I'm assuming that other people have specialties of, the non-wooden ships or the metal ships and submarines and other stuff. But so you're really the perfect guy to ask about this story that I had read at weather.com, which got me going, and I just kept. We were looking at another guest for tonight, originally. And I just kept saying, "What about shipwrecks?" Like every time they would ask my opinion, I go, "What about shipwrecks?" I was fascinated by it, and so it happened that the other guest wasn't available. We booked him on another night, so they asked again. I'm like, "What about shipwrecks?" So we're back to this because I'm so captivated by the notion of how little we know sometimes, or how long it takes for us to figure out what do we have in front of us, and how do we have to go through to actually determine, based on what's left on the bottom of the ocean, what originally had been sailing on top of it. And so that this is your area in terms of how you, the tools you use, you look at, I'm assuming you look at wood and nails and all of the other things that are around the wreck itself in order to determine its origin.
That's correct. The wreck that you're talking about that was just recently discovered in the Gulf, I was looking at video of that, and in what I read, they said they thought that it had burned to the waterline, and I think they're wrong on that. It may have, but I didn't see any evidence of fire. What I was seeing was that the sea worms are actually not a worm. They're a bivalve that sort of drills into the wood. But anyway, I think that had destroyed all of the wood except where it was protected with a copper on its bottom. And I'm
all
not
right.
sure that it's copper. It may be a thing that used to be called yellow metal, which was invented in 1832 or 33. But it's one of the two.
All right.
They'd have to clean some up to actually see, but it looked more like the latter to me. And so that gives us an idea of the date, but it's amazing to see that sitting on the bottom that way.
Let me explain for people who, because I haven't really gone into the story deeply. So I'm just going to read to you from weather.com, and I always like to credit the writers. So this is Jan Wesner Childs, or Jan Childs. A team of NOAA researchers were conducting routine tests on a new underwater remotely operated vehicle in the Gulf of Mexico on May 16th. Not only did the new vehicle perform as expected, it made a startling discovery. The ruins of a previously unknown 19th century ship, ding, 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 Dr. Spencer, paging Dr. Spencer, Dr. Spence, lying in the sand some 1,400 feet below the surface and 160 miles offshore from Florida. Emily Crum, a spokeswoman for NOAA's Office of Ocean Exploration and Research, told the Charlotte Observer that finding the wreck was certainly a surprise. And then they go on to talk about what actually all that they have to be working with. So they estimate that the wreck is 124 feet long. It's a sailing vessel, maybe a schooner or a brig built in the mid-19th century. The ship is wooden with what they said copper sheathing covering the bottom of its hull. But you're saying that you suspect it might not actually be copper.
They started using copper in the late 1700s, and then, as I said, in the 1830s, a man invented a type of brass that just became known as yellow metal or as Muntz metal. The inventor's name was Muntz, and I think that's what they actually have there. There were a couple of other pins and stuff that made me believe that.
Well, it says here then the experts were able to estimate the ship's age based on a number of these construction features, as you mentioned, including the form of the stern and the bow. But then this is the part that really captured me, is the only real telltale part, the only thing that really jumps out at you in terms of helping you determine its origin, was the numbers 2109 are visible along the trailing edge of the shipwreck's udder, 2109. What does that mean to you?
Well, what I'm hoping it is, it may actually be what amounts to the serial number of the ship. Starting, I forget if it was in 1869 or what year, we started issuing official numbers, or at least publishing a record of official numbers of ships. And every ship had to have a number permanently mounted on it. And that may be what those numbers are.
Well, I want you to stick a pin in that right there. This is where we'll pick up the conversation with Dr. Lee Spence, a marine archaeologist. We're talking about that shipwreck, but also shipwrecks in general, and we'll get to some other mysteries of the deep along the way. Because if it were just that simple, 2109, where's the mystery? Just simply go look it up in a registry. So why don't we know automatically what that ship is? There's got to be a reason for that. We'll find out next on Coast to Coast AM. This is Ian Punnett. So we're talking with a guy who has been tracking shipwrecks as a marine archaeologist, going back to a time when there was like 25 of them in the world. And now he's offering his insights as to the latest shipwreck that was found off about 150 miles off the coast of Florida that just had a number on it. And we were just getting to, well, what does that number mean on this shipwreck? And then we'll get to some other shipwreck mysteries next, too. On Coast to Coast AM, this is Ian Punnett. Dr. Lee Spence joins us again here on Coast to Coast AM, 20 years or so after his last appearance on Coast to Coast. Good to have you back. And so we were just talking about this number that was on this shipwreck. As a marine archaeologist, we have a pretty big clue in the number of this mysterious shipwreck off the coast of Florida. It says 2109. So if it had some sort of cladding on the bottom and that number, you're saying that would probably indicate it was some sort of government serial number. But for what kind of ship were the government was our, I guess it would have been the U.S. government, I'm guessing, was allocating numbers like that for?
That's correct. All of the ships, let's call them registered vessels. That's what the government called them. And you had certificates that showed that it was owned by a U.S. company, where it was built, and things like that. And that started in 1860. You can find the list online, but the list online don't start until 1895. And prior to that, you have to have a book that shows it. The books from 1895 to, say, 1965, they've been copied, they've been scanned, and they're online where anybody can look at them. And they're real useful in my shipwreck research, but I actually have a set of them, a complete set, for every year up through, I guess I have it through the 1970s, maybe the 1980s, the complete set. But they're extremely hard to find, and you would pay hundreds of dollars for volumes back in the 1800s or the early part of it, you know, 1860s and all.
Right.
But so I've over the years, I've built a million-dollar library for my shipwreck research.
That's so cool.
So if I was at home, I could look up that number.
So we think that number, 2109, if it's so easy to look up, we could look it up and just go, oh, well, that was a ship that was owned by the, you know, by the General Coffee Company, and they were running coffee from Central America or something, and that got caught in a storm and it burned and it sank. So why would that not be something that the NOAA people already could just determine just as easily?
Well, they may be archaeologists that are looking at it, but they're not necessarily historians.
I see.
If they're not historians, and they may not even know about those numbers. I don't know. It's not something that is normally used, because normally on a shipwreck, you don't find the numbers.
Yeah.
So they may never run into it. I've never seen the numbers on a ship that I was working on the bottom. Never a single time. And I found literally hundreds of shipwrecks. And you said earlier that I focus on the Civil War. I have the most, I'm best known for my work on Civil War shipwrecks, but really I work on other time periods far more than I do the Civil War wrecks.
Really? What other period then would you consider to be your highest expertise?
1700s and early 1800s, that's where my real expertise is.
Interesting. And so that's one of, so you would, though, as you said, of all the ships you've investigated, no one's ever had a number. Just, and that's all it is. There's no name on it, just this number, and then you've never seen one of those before. But theoretically, one could just look it up and they'll find out that this was a ship that was registered to such and such, and it may or may not have burned to the waterline and then sank, as what they were offering. But that, What is the greatest number? What is the most likely cause of a shipwreck? And you can name any period or overall or do whatever. I'm kind of curious about that. Is it mostly natural disasters, or in this case, could it have been a fire on board that somebody knocked over a lamp and they all perished?
It certainly could have happened that way. The most likely thing for a shipwreck, and I'm not talking about this one because that's in 1,400 feet of water, but the most likely cause of a shipwreck is it runs aground. And so most of them are in very shallow water. But probably 90% of those millions of shipwrecks out there are in less than 30 feet of water.
Really?
Yes.
That's great news for the weekend, scuba enthusiast.
Yeah, out at that depth, they may have been sunk by a storm that caused the ship to take on water, broke open a seam or something like that. But fire is a cause. One of the strangest ways that I've heard of a ship burning is that it took on a great deal of water. That caused part of its cargo, which was lime, to start getting hot, just a chemical reaction. And that caused a fire, and the ship burned because it got wet.
Interesting.
Sort of an odd way. Another
Yeah.
odd way that one shipwreck is it had dried peas aboard, and it started taking on water, and the peas swelled and broke the ship open and sank
Oh, shut up. When did that happen?
it. That was one, and I forget if it was in the 1830s or when it was, but
Whoa.
yes, that really happened.
And how often do ships of actually have treasure on them? We would count massive amounts of gold or jewels or something. How often of the shipwrecks that are found actually have sunken treasure with them?
There is a ship that I've found, and I own the rights to now, and a company called Galleon Quest is funding my work on it. But we've just started digging into it, and I've tentatively identified it. And believe it or not, it's another one of George Trenum's ships, but it's pre-Civil War. And although the record does not say that it had treasure on it, the cargo that it carried to Liverpool was cotton and was much more expensive than the cargo it carried back from Liverpool. So the difference in the two cargoes should be what amounts today to be treasure, a lot of it.
Yeah. So, but that's interesting. So, but usually, I mean, I would think that if a ship went to Liverpool and they had their hull full with cotton.
2,700 bales of cotton is what the ship was capable of carrying.
Okay, but then
And
would they be paid in gold, or would they be paid in paper money?
technically, it could be either, but gold was a commodity too, and they speculated in gold. And at that particular time, I would say it would be more likely they were bringing back gold.
And
And go ahead.
how much gold
Well,
then do you think would be on that ship?
I'm still trying to figure that out, but the cargo it brought back was salt, and salt was quite cheap compared to a cargo of cotton. And so it could be in the money at the time, it could be about $200,000 worth of money, of gold. And that would amount, that was when gold was $20 an ounce.
So, I just want to make sure I understand this clearly. So it lists on the return manifest, it lists a shipment of something, but your suspicion is that it would also have had then an amount of gold to have paid for the cotton, because the cotton was more expensive to ship there.
That's correct.
Okay. Wow. So how often does it happen, do you think, then, of all the ships that are laying, say, around the United States, how many of them have something like gold or silver, that how common was it for ships to be carrying any significant amount of gold and silver?
It was actually quite common. They remember you can have a single gold coin from the 1850s be worth hundreds of thousands of dollars. That's one of the rarest time periods. That's when the wreck that we're talking about is from. And so let's say that all it had was $5,000 on it. It still could be millions of dollars worth of coins.
Right. Yeah, and that number that you threw out earlier, the idea that two-thirds, did I get this right? Two-thirds of the gold that has been mined already from the earth is laying on the bottom of the ocean.
Yes, actually, I try to modify what the Smithsonian said, because in my research trying to figure it out, it looks to me like if you said all the gold before 1900, then I can support that. I can show the numbers and hey, it works out, two-thirds of it. But it's a lot of gold either way.
Yeah, really.
Just billions and billions and billions of dollars worth of gold down on the sea floor.
Yeah, what would that do to the world's economy if we were able to retrieve that?
Well, there's billions of dollars of gold buried in the ground that hasn't been taken out. And so it'll take a long time to mine all of those shipwrecks. It's not
Yeah.
going to disrupt it.
And how many people are actively working today, commercially or recreationally, if you would had to estimate, in the recovery of treasure from sunken ships?
I would imagine around the world it's probably a couple thousand people, not archaeologists, but people that are involved in one way or another doing treasure hunting.
How many companies are doing that though, like the one you just mentioned, the Galleon Group?
Galleon Quest.
Yeah, Galleon Quest.
There's not a lot of them, and some of them, they've worked for years and never found anything. And I don't understand that. We go out and we find stuff really every time we're able to go out when the weather's good, we find something. And we bring up cargo, but a lot of this cargo is extremely valuable. And one of the wrecks we're working is from the 1790s, late 1790s. And I'm convinced that when we actually find out its name, we don't know the name of it, but and it's actually mixed in with the other one that I was just talking about. The wrecks are commingled, the pieces from them. But that ship apparently was had a cargo going to a jeweler, probably in Charleston, and we find crucifixes, we found a locket, an extremely rare kind of gold locket with black pearls around it. But I'd love to know what the name of that ship was.
Yeah, really. And you can't you can find the ship and ultimately never know exactly the name of the ship or the history of why it went down.
Yes, that's possible, but I'm convinced we will find it on this one. But where we're running into problems is that during the time period that that ship went down, the newspapers in Charleston no longer exist. And so it was probably in the newspapers, but we don't have a copy of those newspapers
Yeah,
to look
really.
through.
We're talking with Dr. Lee Spence about marine archaeology, shipwrecks, underwater treasure, and in particular, this story that was on weather.com. NOAA found a, they were doing a little research and they accidentally found a rare numbered ship. And as Dr. Spence already explained, there's no real explanation. I mean, he has never seen a numbered ship before of all of the wrecks where he's found. But presumably, we'll be able to just look up the, find the right registry, we'll be able to look up that ship. But even still, you can't know what's on them because a lot of, you don't have the manifest, you don't know what they were transporting, and who knows what the treasure might be. So what do you do, how do you feel about these ships as grave sites? How do you process all of that?
Well, on all of the shipwrecks that I've ever dived, I have never found a single body. Most of the time when ships wreck, they run aground, and so most of them, the people get off, or they jump overboard and try to swim for it, and they drown, and their bodies float off. There are times that people have found human remains on old shipwrecks, but that's not the normal. The normal thing is there's nothing like that that's actually found, because everybody was up on deck when the ship, if they knew the ship was going down, they're all coming up topside trying to get off. And right. So they're just washed away.
Right. I saw a video from the wreck of the Edmund Fitzgerald. And, you know, there's that line in the song, The Wreck of the Edmund Fitzgerald, is a, you know, about how the Lake Superior never gives up her dead. And the diver explained that that had to do with the unique coldness of the water, and that there were still bodies that were sort of preserved in the bottom of Lake Superior because of its icy condition. But that's not the kind of that. Does that have the ring of truth to it, to you, and or is that something which?
Yes,
you know,
yes, it does. We were working a wreck in Lake Huron, and when it wrecked, the whole crew was lost. In fact, there were 13 ships lost in that storm. It was a November storm in 1913. And we were getting cases of champagne, cases of scotch, and stuff like that off of the shipwreck. So theoretically, you could find a body in that wreck, and it would still, it'd still be a body. But on that particular wreck, all of the bodies are accounted for except for one of them. So even though that crew died, only one body was not recovered. The captain's body was recovered over a year later. It floated ashore.
After they started doing the work on the shipwreck?
No, the shipwreck wasn't found for...
Oh, I see. It floated offshore a year after the ship
that's
sank.
That's correct.
No. Okay, I see.
And we never found any human remains on that shipwreck. Whether the missing guy is trapped inside the thing, I don't know.
Yeah.
That ship is fairly intact. It's sitting upside down. I've been inside of it, and we did find a lot of stuff, but we saw no human remains at all.
You know, what
there
I
have
saw
been wrecks that people have found them, but those are normally warships and all. And warships, my feeling on them, the Arizona, because they built a walkway out to the wreck, and there are so many people that were entombed in it, and it was an iron ship and not a wood one that breaks up and all, I think it's appropriate to have it as a grave.
Yeah.
But that's not the normal, and my feeling is that if I found human remains on a shipwreck, I would want to to bring them up, try to locate the families, and allow the families to do a proper burial according to whatever religion they had.
Yeah,
that to me would be the right thing. We don't leave people in car wrecks on the side of the road. Or if an airplane crashes, we try to recover all the bodies. Even if it's at sea, we still try to recover all of the bodies. I think the idea of saying all these ships are grave sites is absolutely absurd. It's just a way for some of the government officials to say, hey, the public owns these wrecks. You can't dive on them. They're graveyards.
I want you to hang on to that thought right there. That's just where I want to start. The government on this next on Coast to Coast AM. This is Ian Punnett.